And continuing our newspaper coverage on this Wednesday, the 8th of April, 2026, time now to begin the reading of today's Boston Herald. And we say hello today to Fred and Danny.
Hi, John.
Hi, John. This is Fred. I'll start it off today since Ed's not here. And we'll start with the Herald's most famous, infamous, whatever you want, Howie Carr, the great Howie Carr. Maura Healey shooting political blanks. As the booze rained down on her, her politics fail. Which of Boston's wokest institutions is having a worst April? Governor Maura Healey or the Boston Red Sox? That booing at Fenway Park was bad considering the crowds there. There hasn't been anyone at the opening day for the last 20 years who wasn't a beautiful person. Still, the boo birds were just the beginning of Maura's headache. Granted, she's still a heavy favorite to win the re-election, but not even her slobbering fluffers in regime-controlled media in Boston can keep disaster that Healey has presided over. On Sunday, even the Boston Globe, which reveres Maura, had finally admit that the obvious in this headache, Massachusetts has the highest electric bills in the continental United States. No kidding, you say. You always knew that. Of course you did, from the studying your electric bills in horror. But most Globe readers have had their bills paid for directly from the trust funds, or they live in the public housing, like real jobs. They're just a rumor to most Globe readers. Until Sunday, the Globe had long been denying the obvious. In September of 24, they claimed that Massachusetts bills were just among the highest. By last December, the legacies and the DEI types in the newsroom were willing to concede that our rates are at nosebleed level. No rankings, please. But now they've admitted the obvious. So Maura fled to so-called media. Someone must have told her that normal people like to go to Dunkin'. How many times now has she tried to wrap herself up in the mantle of Dunkin'? So now she's done a video. There she's comparing the various sources of energy in the Commonwealth to Munchkins. It was sad, even by Maura Healey standards. You watch it and you realize her insane green energy cult is the equivalent of sticking a day-end crawler up the taxpayers. Maura's energy fantasy world is coming apart so fast that the Globe can finally had to run a story about two ex-Stoneham cops who stole $40 million from Mass Saves while nobody in the state government noticed anything. It was left to the feds to lock up the Ponzo brothers, stop me if you heard this one before. For more than a year, the Globe's been giving mega scandal a good leaving alone because it's not good for the party. But finally, they felt compelled to mention that the brothers locked up at Old Fort Dix lost their appeal. Another tough break for the narrative. Next thing you know, maybe the Globe will get some photos of the two Ponzo brothers. The Stoneham PD will give them to you. It took me one call last summer. Maybe the Globe doesn't have the Stoneham PD's phone number. In Healey's desperate attempts to bond with the voters who were actually raised in Massachusetts, she has recently become a big proponent of the Second Amendment. Pay no attention to her earlier hysterics now that she's all in for Sunday hunting. Plus, she went to the gun range, where she showed as much familiarity with firearms as Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota. What's next? Is Maura going to buy a pickup truck? Next, she realized she has a problem with welfare fraud, especially by her beloved illegal aliens. Maura said Monday that she decided to put tracking chips in the state's SNAP cards. That would say that she's a day late and $1 billion short. Of course, within the moments of Healey announcing her alleged crackdown with the great fanfare on Monday, U.S. Attorney Leah Foley put out the press release, Worcester man charged with SNAP fraud. Of course, Worcester man is a Dominican illegal alien identified as John Doe, prefer to call him Juan Doe. Juan Doe was truly a poster boy for Maura Healey's Massachusetts. The Cholo was convicted in 2012 in Worcester for A and B with a dangerous weapon and trafficking cocaine. Lamar Cook could not be reached for comment. When Juan Doe got put out in 2022, the justice involved newcomer to our land's first stop was at, where else, the welfare office. There he used a dead American's Social Security number to get back on the dole. Last week, after allegedly stealing $12,623 in food stamps from us gringos, the Cholo was busted again. Thus far, Maura Healey has not called a press conference to brag about turning him in, but so many scandals remain that Maura dares not touch even with a 10-foot pole. Take the state police, please. She can't do anything about them. Obviously, they know too much, way too much. But the troopers are so corrupt, they just can't help themselves, especially when they're working for Democratic district attorneys. You know how much Maura and her gang of glowering gals and transitioning beta males love Norfolk D.A. Michael Meatball Morrissey. He was a Kamala Harris delegate in 2024, which makes him good people. But Meatball was too toxic to run for re-election, and now it turns out his Sandra Birchmore scandal continues to get even worse. Not even could his crooked state cops not find 32,000 text messages between the pregnant 23-year-old and her alleged murderer in Canton in 2021. Now the Fed's telling us that Meatball's crooked troopers never even bothered to get DNA samples from her alleged pedophile cop murderer for 3.5 years. And now the other septuagenarian Democrat, D.A. Marion Ryan of Middlesex County, is all jammed up with their MSP detectives. Her office, the state police, covered up a different death for two-plus years. So far, we have from Ryan's office one state he arrested and suspended without pay, another relieved of duty with pay, and a third on a restricted duty. And the one who initially investigated the fatal is indicted in a different scandal for her involuntary manslaughter and perjury. Maura's response? Crickets. She says nothing. She better not. Not if she knows what's good for her. Just send the troopers a couple of dozen munchies and a condolence card. Now, how bad is April going to be for Maura Healey? Yesterday, she canceled the press conference at the last moment. What was the problem? The $80 train tickets to Gillette for the World Cup, the legislature audit, more layoffs, plunging property values. Look at it this way, Maura. As bad as things are going in April, they could get worse. You could be in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Thanks, Fred. In today's page 2 of the Boston Herald, state police scandal. Quigley arraignment scheduled. Stady charged after alleged drunken cruiser crash in 2023. The story by Colleen Cronin. A Massachusetts state police sergeant will be arraigned on a motor vehicle homicide charge next week, more than 2 years after he allegedly drunkenly crashed a cruiser into a wheelchair van. Sergeant Scott Quigley will go before a judge the afternoon of April 15 at Middlesex Superior Court in Woburn, according to court records. A statewide grand jury handed down an indictment against Quigley, at the end of March, after the Middlesex County District Attorney's Office, where the sergeant was embedded as a homicide investigator, referred the case to the Suffolk DA's office in January. Middlesex DA Marion Ryan said that her office became aware of the allegations that at the time of the 2023 crash, Quigley had a blood alcohol level of 0.11. The legal limit is 0.08. Because of a wrongful death suit filed in another county by the family of Special Olympian Angelo Schettino. Schettino was an occupant in the wheelchair van injured in the crash with Quigley. He died in the hospital about a month later. Middlesex disclosed the allegation in the Middlesex of the middle of a jury impanelment for a Lowell murder trial in February, making the accusation public for the first time. The disclosure paused the trial of brothers Billy Oham and Chana Fan, who are accused of killing 20-year-old Tyrone Fett in 2020. Quigley had been the lead investigator on the Fan's case. Since the disclosure, both the state police and the Middlesex DA initiated independent reviews of their handling of the crash. The independent report on the DA's office cleared them, but the MSP report has not been completed. Quigley has been suspended without pay since early February. An internal affairs probe into members of the state police involved in the crash and its investigation is also ongoing. Fred?
From Duxbury, Clancy willing to confess if the trial is split. Duxbury mom allegedly strangled her kids, Cora 5, Dawson 3, and Callan 8 months in January of 2023. Lindsay Clancy is willing to admit that she killed her three children, according to a motion filed by her attorney last week, if her murder trial is split in two proceedings. Clancy allegedly strangled her three kids, Cora, Dawson, and Callan, in January 23, and then tried to kill herself by jumping out the second floor window of a Duxbury home. Her defense lawyer, Kevin Reddington, argued that Clancy was suffering from postpartum psychosis at the time and isn't criminally responsible for the deaths. The defendant states that the issue of the action resulted from the death of the decedents in an indictment at the bar is not a live issue, and the defendant is willing to stipulate formally in writing that her involvement in the underlying conduct resulted in the deaths of the three young children, Reddington wrote in an April 2nd filing. With that understanding, the defendant submits that the only live issue for consideration at trial would be the defendant's state of mind as it relates to the defense of lack of criminal responsibility, he continued. The motion, which renews a request for bifurcated trials, comes after a judge denied Reddington's initial request to split the trial into two parts, one of which would decide guilty, and that the other would decide whether she was legally sane. The Commonwealth had argued against the split, saying that Clancy didn't have a constitutional right to a bifurcated trial, and that allowing one would mean that they'd have to present nearly identical evidence in both proceedings. The defendant understands that the government has the right to prove its case, Reddington wrote, but where there is an agreement for a stipulation, the defendant submits that it is an elevated form over the substance to require a full-blown trial in the issue of culpability as opposed to criminal. Clancy is currently at Tewksbury State Hospital, where she's receiving both mental health treatment and care for the injuries she sustained following her suicide attempt. Reddington said that she is suicidal at times and partially paralyzed. Patrick Clancy, the defendant's husband and the father of the three kids, filed a wrongful death suit against his wife's health care provider in January. The complainant claims that her providers improperly and overly medicated Clancy after she reported postpartum depression and other mental health symptoms. The suit, filed in Norfolk County Court, also describes Clancy's rapid decline in the months and weeks leading up to the killings. Since the death of the children, Clancy's husband has been supportive, telling The New Yorker in a 2024 article, "I wasn't married to a monster. I was married to someone who got sick." Clancy's trial in Plymouth Superior Court is set to start in July, but the next court date is a state conference scheduled for April 23rd.
This story, also from page 2 in today's Boston Herald, police shooting. DA IDs sword-wielding man killed by police. Story by Colleen Cronin. A 29-year-old Boston man has been identified as the person shot and killed by police over the weekend after he allegedly stabbed first responders with a sword during a mental health crisis. The Suffolk County District Attorney's Office said Jacob Graves attacked and injured both Boston police and EMS responders with a sword-type weapon near Northeastern University Saturday night, leading to an officer to tase and then to shoot him. Graves had called 911 from his Hemingway Street apartment claiming people with guns were trying to hurt him, the police said. But according to Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox, when officers arrived, they spoke with Graves for between 35 and 45 minutes through his apartment door. As they began and they asked the individual to begin the process of maybe coming up and seeking the attention they needed, the individual immediately opened the door and struck both the clinician and an officer who was outside the door, Cox said. The DA's office is investigating the incident, but immediately following the shooting, both DA Kevin Hayden and Commissioner Cox said that it appeared that the officers acted properly. Cox told the press that initial information suggested the use of the firearm was properly justified in this case. I think it's going to be quite some time before we're going to be able to have a full picture of exactly what happened here, Hayden said. But our first responders, all of them, I think, responded to the scene the best they can. The fatal officer-involved shooting is the second in the city in the last month. Officer Nicholas O'Malley shot and killed carjack suspect Stevenson King in mid-March. O'Malley was charged with manslaughter 8 days later, a move by the DA's office that union representatives and some elected officials have criticized. Fred?
Parole Board releases another killer. In 2008, broad daylight slaying was in front of a bustling post office. The State Parole Board is releasing another emerging adult first-degree murderer who killed a hated rival in a brazen broad daylight shooting in front of the bustling post office. Patrick Greer was 20 years old in 2008, and he gunned down 16-year-old DeAndre Barboza in Boston. Greer, 2 years later, was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But in 2024, Greer became eligible for parole after the state Supreme Court's decision in Commonwealth versus Mattis. The court ruled that emerging adult offenders who were 18 to 20 at the time of the offense could not be sentenced to life without parole. As a result of the SJC's decision regarding his first-degree murder conviction, Greer was resentenced to life with the possibility of parole after 15 years. Greer is now 37 years old, and the Massachusetts Parole Board has okayed his release. The deadly shooting back in November 30th of 2008, Greer and his co-defendant, a 16-year-old girl, were at a store in in Dorchester when they saw Barboza. Greer talked to Barboza, and afterwards Greer appeared quiet and upset. The next morning, Greer met up with his co-defendant in Dorchester. As the pair were passing a market on Washington Street, they spotted Barboza inside. Barboza then left the market, and both Greer and Barboza walked toward Codman Square at the corner. When Barboza reached the corner in front of the busy post office, Greer shot him, causing him to fall to the ground. With Barboza on the ground, Greer continued to fire at him from point-blank range. One shot struck Barboza in the head, two others wounded his legs. Barboza was transported to Boston Medical Center, where he died 2 days later from the gunshot wound of the head. Right after the shooting, Greer and his co-defendant fled the scene. Greer threw the gun he used to shoot Barboza at his co-defendant, telling the 16-year-old girl to take it. She caught the gun, a .22-caliber revolver, and tucked it into her waistband before continuing to flee. Police officers then apprehended Greer and the 16-year-old girl and recovered the gun. Samples were taken from their hands, which tested positive for gunshot residue. Greer and Barboza came from different neighborhoods, and the homicide stemming from an ongoing feud, according to the Suffolk County DA prosecutor during the arraignment years ago. Parole decision. Last year, Greer appeared before the Massachusetts Parole Board for an initial hearing. Mr. Greer presented with insight into the causative factors that led to his gang affiliation and offending behavior, the parole board wrote in its ruling. Mr. Greer began to invest in self-development prior to the Mattis decision and furthered his rehabilitation by participating and competing in programs relative to his need areas. Mr. Greer also invested in education, earning his associate degree, the parole board said. In an effort to prepare himself for reentry, Mr. Greer also developed an occupational skills. The board concluded that Patrick Greer had demonstrated a level of rehabilitation that would make his release compatible with the welfare of society. The Massachusetts Parole Board has released dozens of emerging adult first-degree convicted murderers who were 18 to 20 at the time of the offense. The Mattis ruling in 2024 made more than 200 convicts eligible for parole hearings.
Feds put freeze on $1 million fake Botox spa. Owner admits performing illegal procedures and injections. This from the Boston Herald, written by Rick Sobey. A local spa owner has admitted to performing thousands of injections using fake Botox and dermal fillers that were imported from China and Brazil. Stoughton woman Rebecca Fadinelli, 40, owned and operated Skin Boutte Med Spa in Randolph and Southeastern. She was not licensed to perform injections, and she ended up receiving more than $1 million in client payments for these illegal procedures, according to the feds. Fadinelli imported counterfeit Botox, Sculptra, and Juvederm from China and Brazil, and she performed thousands of injections using these and other counterfeit drugs and devices. Fadinelli falsely represented to her clients and employees that she was a nurse. In fact, Fadinelli is an esthetician and was never licensed to perform injections or otherwise dispense or administer prescription drugs or devices, the feds wrote. According to payment records from 2021 to 2024, Fadinelli completed about 1,631 Botox appointments, totaling $522,000 in client payments, and 1,085 filler appointments, totaling $410,545 in client payments. She pleaded guilty in Boston federal court on Tuesday to four counts of importing merchandise contrary to law, two counts of selling or dispensing a counterfeit drug, and two counts of selling or dispensing a counterfeit device. The federal judge scheduled sentencing for July 1st. The charge of importing merchandise contrary to law can lead to a sentence of up to 20 years in prison, 3 years of supervised release, and a fine of $250,000. The charges of knowingly selling or dispensing a counterfeit drug or a counterfeit device can lead to a prison sentence of up to 10 years in prison, 3 years of supervised release, and a fine of $250,000. If you or a family member believe you received services involving a counterfeit drug or a counterfeit device from Fatinelli and or Skin Butte Med Spa, the feds are urging you to complete the questionnaire on the FDA website at the Office of Criminal Investigations Victim Witness page, OCI Victim Witness Assistance. Fred?
Under attack on Iran, Trump, Iran agree on 2-week ceasefire. Agreement struck hours after the whole civilization will die threat. Tehran, Iran, a U.S. President, Donald Trump, announced a dramatic 2-week ceasefire with Iran Tuesday, swerving to de-escalate the war less than 2 hours before the deadline he set for Tehran to capitulate and the whole civilization will die, unquote. Trump said he was holding off on threatening attacks on Iranian bridges, power plants, and other civilian targets, subject to Tehran agreeing to a 2-week ceasefire and reopening the Straits of Hormuz, the waterway through which a fifth of the world's oil is shipped during peacetime. He also said Iran has proposed a workable 10-point peace plan that could help end the war launched by the U.S. and Israel in February. Iran's Supreme National Security Council said it has accepted a 2-week ceasefire and that it would negotiate with the United States in Islamabad beginning Friday. I agree to suspend the bombing of the attack on Iran for a period of 2 weeks. This will be a double-sided ceasefire, Trump wrote. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said a passage through the straits would be allowed for the next 2 weeks under Iranian military management. It wasn't exactly clear what that meant, whether it meant Iran would loosen its chokehold on the waterway. In a post on his social media, Trump said that he would suspend attacks on Iran for 2 weeks, provided Tehran agreed to the complete, immediate, and safe opening of the strait. Even as the ceasefire was announced, missile alerts continued in the United Arab Emirates and Israel early Wednesday, hinting at the chaos surrounding the diplomatic moves. Since the war began, Trump has repeatedly backed off deadlines just before they expire. In doing so Tuesday, Trump said he had come to the decision based on conversations with Pakistan Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and General Asim Manir, Pakistan's powerful army chief. Sharif, in a post on X hours earlier, urged Trump to extend his deadline by 2 weeks to allow diplomacy to advance. He raised the same post to ask Iran to open the straits for 2 weeks. The president said that his social media post that Iran has presented a workable basis upon which to negotiate. Almost all of the various points of past contention have been agreed to between the United States and Iran, but a 2-week period will allow the agreement to be finalized and consummated, Trump said. Trump threats raised alarms. Trump's expansive threat Tuesday did not seem to account for potential harm to civilians, prompting civilian Democrats in Congress, some United States officials, and scholars in military law to say how such strikes would violate international law. Tehran's representative in the United Nations, Amir Saeed Iravani, said that the threats constitute incitement to war crimes and potential genocide, and that Iran would take immediate and proportionate reciprocal measures if Trump launches devastating strikes. The U.S. and Israel have battered Iran with attacks, targeting its military capabilities and leadership. An unclear program in Iran has responded on Israel and the Gulf's Arab neighbors, causing regional chaos and outsized economic and political shock. Before the deadline, airstrikes hit two bridges and a train station, and the U.S. hit military infrastructure in Karg Island, a key hub for the Iranian oil production. Trump has extended deadlines before. Since the war began, Trump has repeatedly imposed deadlines, linking the threats only to extend them. Tehran previously rejected a 45-day ceasefire proposal by Egyptian, Pakistani, and Turkish mediators, saying that it wants a permanent end to the war. Iran's president said 14 million people, including himself, have volunteered to fight. That despite Trump's saying that the U.S. forces could wipe out all bridges in Iran in a matter of hours and reduce the power plants to smoking rubble in roughly the same amount of time. It was not clear if the airstrike against Iran on Tuesday will link to Trump's threats to widen the civilian target list. At least two of the targets were connected to the Iran's rail network, and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israeli warplanes struck the bridges and railroads in Iran. Tehran fired on Israel and Saudi Arabia promptly, and the temporary closures of the major bridge. While Iran cannot match the sophistication of the U.S. and Israel weaponry, Their dominance of the air, its chokehold on the straits since the war began late February, is roiling the world economy and raising the pressure on Trump, both at home and abroad, to find a way out of the standoff. Trump keeps an off-ramp open. While civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, if a deal isn't reached, Trump said that an online post Tuesday morning, but he also seemed to keep open the possibility of an off-ramp, saying that maybe something revolutionary and wonderful can happen. A general in Iran's Revolutionary Guard, warned that Iran will deprive the United States and its allies of the regional oil and gas for years and expand the attacks across the Gulf if Trump carries out his threat. Following the ceasefire announcement, oil prices plunged and the U.S. stock futures jumped. U.S. crude oil futures fell more than 15%. Futures for the S&P 500 were up 2.2% as of 8.05 p.m. Eastern Time, while Dow futures rose 930 points, or 2%. In Tehran on Tuesday, the mood was bleak. A young teacher said that many opponents of Iran's Islamic system had hoped Trump's attacks would quickly topple it as the war drags on, and fears that the U.S. and Israeli strikes could spread chaos. If you don't have the internet, and if you don't have electricity, water, and gas, we're going to go back to the Stone Age, as Trump said, she said, speaking on the condition of anonymity for her safety. In Rome, Pope Leo XIV said Tuesday that the threats were truly unacceptable and that such attacks would violate international law.
From today's Herald Opinion Page editorial, $80 T-Train tickets to World Cup are affordable? For who? According to the T, the $80 round-trip commuter rail tickets for this summer's World Cup at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough are a predictable and more affordable way to travel to and from matches. Affordable for who, exactly? For some free-spending fans pouring in from around the country and the world, already splashing out on airfare, hotels and dining, an extra $80 is probably not a make or break for them, but for others, it's outrageous. As the Independent reported, the Free Lions, the Football Supporters Association Fans Embassy Service for traveling England fans, condemned the cost on social media. At what is normally a $20 return, we are incredibly disappointed that this has been allowed to happen, the group said. For a stadium so far away from its advertised location, all organizers had a duty to ensure supporters could get there sustainably and for a fair price. Unfortunately, like much with this tournament, supporters are gouged. Many local fans can share their pain. With our service plans and pricing announced today, we encourage the public to kick the drive and use the MBTA's Boston Stadium train service instead. MBTA GM and CEO Philip Ng said in a statement, taking the commuter rail will be one of the easiest and most affordable ways to get to and from the stadium, added Ng, who's also MassDOT's interim secretary. There's the A word again. Affordable is relative here. Parking will be limited at Gillette, with spots starting at $175. You could cram a car with people and split the parking cost, but that won't help a family with children. On paper, the sky-high commuter rail tickets make sense. The MBTA upgraded Foxborough Station in advance of the World Cup, a $35 million project, and there are other costs, such as security and customer service staff, to pay for. You have to recoup costs somewhere. In fiscal terms, it's a win. In accessibility terms, it's not. Not everyone is doing well in the Bay State. Ironically, just after the World Cup commuter rail ticket price hike was announced, the Greater Boston Food Bank and Mass General Brigham dropped its annual report. The sixth annual Massachusetts Food Access Report found a record 40% of Massachusetts households experienced food insecurity during 2025. The report also found that 25% of households report regularly missing meals or going hungry. That's a sobering snapshot of reality for almost half of the Bay State. An $80 round trip to seeing the World Cup, in addition to shelling out for the tickets, is well out of reach. Yes, a $80 train ticket is more affordable than a $175 parking spot, but if you're struggling, those numbers are just different degrees of not going to happen. For local fans without plush paychecks, they can see the World Cup as they doubtless have in years when it was held abroad, on TV, at home, or at a local watch party. The T will recoup a nice chunk of that $35 million spent on Foxborough Stadium improvements, an estimated 20,000 riders a day at $80 a pop over seven matches is a cool $11.2 million, give or take, but it's lost a lot of goodwill with the soccer-loving public. Fred?
Under Biz Smart, a Band-Aid for health spending, $300 million approved to cover soaring state health care costs. Governor Maura Healey and the Massachusetts legislature have passed and signed another supplemental budget, this time appropriating $300 million to fund health insurance, for the public employees as health care costs continue to burden the state budget. The House and Senate both passed the emergency legislation, H-5348, during the informal session Monday, with Healey signing it into law later in the day. The lawmakers say that the funding ensures that the 460,000 public employees, retirees, and dependents who access health care through the Group Insurance Commission face no interruptions in their coverage. The GIC is a quasi-independent state agency. Given the hundreds of thousands of Massachusetts residents' access to their health care through the Group Insurance Commission, ensuring that it is adequately funded is of vital importance, said House Speaker Ron Mariano. I want to thank Chairman Michalowicz and my colleagues in the House, as well as our partners in the Senate, for recognizing the urgent need for this funding. Health care is a fundamental promise we make to the public employees, retirees, and families who keep our Commonwealth running. Today, the legislature acted together to ensure that more than 460,000 people can continue to access the care that they rely on without disruption. I'm grateful to the Chair Rodriguez for his leadership in this legislation, and to our partners in the House for their collaboration on this critical need, added Senate President Karen Spilker. The $300 million in funding, which will only cover GIC costs through the end of the current fiscal year in June, will be taken out of the fiscal 26 general fund revenues. Lawmakers cite higher than anticipated utilization and pharmaceutical expenses for the soaring health care costs. This, as GIC has already been looking to trim the fat, with its board voting in February to stop covering GLP drugs for weight loss and saving an estimated $26 million. With a swift passage of this minimum supplemental budget, the legislature is prioritizing access to vital health care for the state employees. In doing our due diligence, paying providers on time for the health care services our residents depend on, said Chair of the State Ways and Means Committee, and the state and the Senator Michael Rodriguez of Westport. Identical funding was proposed in both the House and the Senate this year in their respective versions of the broader supplemental budget, which remains before the legislature. Total health care response spending in Massachusetts per capita grew to 5.7% between 23 and 24, while the benchmark was set at 3.6%. A Center of Health Information and Analysis report found last month.
From today's Red Sox notebook in the Herald, Cora responds to fans' "Sell the Team" chants by Gabrielle Starr. The chants grew louder as the Red Sox careened toward their eighth loss just 10 games into the season. "Sell the team! Sell the team!" Fenway Park wasn't sold out, nor did many of the 35,107 paying customers stay until the end, but the chants continued to ring loud and clear, even as the crowd dwindled. And as Trevor Story made the final out in the bottom of the ninth, boos echoed through the Major League Baseball's oldest ballpark. The Red Sox entered Tuesday 2-8, matching their worst record through the first 10 games of a season in franchise history. They have the fewest wins and became the first team in the majors to reach 8 losses this year, joined hours later by the 3-8 San Francisco Giants. They rank second in errors, have the third worst run difference, and are winless in 3 one-run games. Their starting rotation, projected to be one of the MLB's crown jewels this year, has not only allowed more hits and runs than any other American League team's starting staff, but has done so over the fourth lowest innings pitch total. Everything seems to be going wrong for them at the same time. And even when something is going right, or at least less wrong, the offense has been slightly less anemic over the last two games. It isn't enough to overcome the rest of the mess. Red Sox manager Alex Cora said after Monday loss that he understands fans' displeasure. "That's how it works," Cora said. "That's why we love it here, right? Because their expectations are up there with us. Right now, we deserve whatever they're thinking, and we're not playing good baseball, and we know it." Cora weighs in on Contreras. After getting hit by a pitch by the Milwaukee Brewers pitcher for the 24th time in his career Monday night, Wilson Contreras made his feelings clear. "They always say, 'I'm not trying to hit you,'" the Red Sox first baseman said after his team's 8-6 loss. "That gets old, so the next time they hit me again, I'm going to take one of them out. That's the message." Cora said pregame Tuesday he was proud of Contreras for putting the game first. "One thing we know about him, and we all know it, he plays with emotion. He plays with a chip on his shoulder," Cora said. "And yesterday, I know he was hot, but he was able to slow it down and put good at-bats. I like the fact that he cares," Cora continued. "I like the fact that he loves playing the game. He does. But I really like the fact that he plays the way he wants to play. Let's put it that way." Contreras reached base five times Monday night, matching his career high for the fourth time, first since August 11th, 2023. In addition to the hit-by-pitch, he went 3-for-3 with a solo home run, double, two RBIs, and a walk. Through four games of this first homestand, he's 5-for-14, 357, with four runs, two homers, and three RBI and three walks. For a Red Sox team that entered Tuesday with the fewest wins and tied for the most losses in Major League Baseball, Contreras is crucial to a turnaround. "During the game, I talked to him like we need him," Cora said. "He's a big part of what we're trying to accomplish. He's a good hitter. He's a good defender. So try to keep him in the game. He was very emotional yesterday during and, I guess, after. But today he's calmed down, so we'll see how it plays out. But he knows that we need him, and we'll do our best to keep him in the lineup and keep him in the game." Cora said he's never been in the situation Contreras finds himself in, as the first baseman's 130 career hit-by-pitches rank second among major league active players. Cora has had 90 hit-by-pitches himself in his 14-year playing career, but never more than eight times by any one team. Brandon Woodruff, who started Monday's series opener for Milwaukee and delivered the pitch that infuriated Contreras, had already plunked him five times in seven games dating back to 2018. Asked if he was confident that Contreras wouldn't do anything to get himself thrown out of the game, Cora said, "We'll see, right? See and react. My job as manager is to make sure he's in the lineup, that he stays in the game," Cora continued. "And yesterday, we did a good job of that, and he had a tremendous game. If it feels like he's swinging the bat a lot better, he feels very comfortable. So we need that big boy in the lineup." Fred?
Projecting Celtics playoff rotation as postseason is. The Celtics played their first 77 games of this NBA season without their full master roster available. They won 52 of them, riding their depth to a second-best record in the Eastern Conference. Now, with Jason Tatum back and in the fold, Nikola Vukovic, recently reactivated, head coach Joe Mazzulla finally has a complete allotment of players to work with. With less than a week remaining in the regular season, the Celtics are whole. The question now with Boston's first-round series set to tip off the next weekend, how's Mazzulla going to deploy these players in the playoffs when coaches typically shorten their bench and lean more on their regulars? The makeup of the Celtics rotation, with its fluctuating, which fluctuated throughout the season, could depend upon whether the opponent it draws in the opening round. Toronto Raptors, Philadelphia 76ers, Charlotte Hornets, Orlando Magic, all could land in that spot, and each with the presents of different matchups. And here's where things stand for Boston entering Tuesday's meeting with Charlotte at the TD Garden. Starters: Derek White, Jaylen Brown, Sam Hauser, Jason Tatum, Nehemias Kata. Four-fifths of the unit is locked in. While Brown and Kata have been season-long starters, and Tatum has started every game since he's played since he returned from the Achilles surgery in March, he's looked playoff ready, to over averaging 21.5 points, 10.1 rebounds, and 5.2 assists per game, while steadily improving as a shooter. The Celtics are 12-2 with Tatum at the lineup and have lost just once with him and Brown both active. Hauser's spot in the starting five is the least secure. He came off the bench one game last week, and with Mazzulla choosing to start Jordan Walsh and Baylor Schneiderman against Atlanta, while Tatum sat out. But this was only the only time during since New Year's Day that Hauser played and did not start. The 28-year-old sharpshooter has been part of the top unit in 41 of his 42 games, and he's likely to remain there in the beginning of the postseason. It's worth noting, however, that the Celtics' starting lineup has not been the same in closing lineup. Of the 142 minutes that White, Brown, Hauser, Tatum, Kata group has played together this season, during which it posted a plus 5.5 net rating, just three came in the fourth quarter. Top reserves: Peyton Pritchard, Baylor Shireman, and Nikola Vukovic. The Celtics' decision to trade Anfernee Simons for Vukovic in early February pushed Pritchard, last season's NBA Sixth Man of the Year, back to the bench to balance the Boston's lineup. But the 6-foot-1 guard is essentially a sixth starter, and his playing time has actually increased since his demotion. Pritchard is a staple of the Celtics' aforementioned closing lineup. In 28 appearances since the Simons trade, he's played in emerging the entire fourth quarter 11 times and come close in seven others. Only Brown and White have averaged more minutes per minute and more per game than Pritchard during that span. Boston's second most common lineup since the Tatum's return, which swaps Pritchard for Hauser alongside another four starters, has outscored opponents by 56 points over 48 minutes. Shireman has stood atop the Celtics' pile of energetic young wings for the past 2 months, logging at least 17 minutes in each of the last 20 games. And despite playing with the fractured thumb on his shooting hand in the second year, the pro has made 40% of his three-pointers since Tatum's debut, and also providing effective offensive rebounding and competitive defense. Vukovic is the Celtics' biggest question mark. The 35-year-old took over as Boston's number two center when he arrived from Chicago, and he immediately reclaimed that spot Sunday after returning from the fractured ring finger that sidelined him for a month. But he struggled in the win over Toronto, minus 14 in 13 minutes, and was inconsistent before his injury, with the strongest performance coming against lottery teams. The Celtics like the difference between Vukovic can bring to their offense with his shooting, passing, and piling post-up ability, but he has limited time to deal, to dial up his chemistry with his teammates before the postseason tips off. Luka Garza, who's played well in most of his appearances since late December, is another viable option for Vukovic scuffles if the Mazzulla opts to play three bigs. Mazzulla has used an eight-man rotation in the majority of Boston playoff games during the tenure, including that with the last season. Wild cards: Jordan Walsh, Hugo Gomez, Gonzalez, Luka Garza, Ron Harper Jr. For most of the season, Gonzalez looked poised to become the first Celtic rookie since 2021 to see a meaningful playoff minutes. His new role is far murkier. The 20-year-old playing time has cratered over the last week. After lagging first half minutes in every game since December 5th, Gonzalez did not check in until garbage time in Boston's wins over Milwaukee, Miami, and Toronto. While Gonzalez has slipped down in the depth chart, Walsh has surfaced. Bounced from the rotation by Tatum's comeback, Walsh has played in six straight games, including two starts over during his six consecutive did not play games. He grabbed seven rebounds at least last Sunday's win in Charlotte, and had two blocks and steals in Monday's loss to Atlanta, and converted to steal and score Monday against Toronto to help Boston pull away in the fourth quarter. You want guys that you know when you put in, whether or not it's 5 minutes or 20 minutes, you can rely on them and make the plays, Mazzulla said. And Walsh does that, especially on the defensive end. Harper, who had his two-way contract converted to a standard deal over the weekend, is likely to play unless the Celts suffer multiple injuries. And that'll be it today. No more time.
Thank you.